Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Oh, when I die, please bury me beside the old ball yard, or maybe near the ocean if that first choice is too hard, a quiet spot beneath an oak, or even next to town, but not, please, in a freezer, lads. No, put me in the ground. More on the unfortunate dispute over the remains of the greatest hitter who ever lived, and lots more baseball news as well later. First, though, I'm joined by Clay Callum, who covers the WNBA for Full Court Press magazine. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks much. It's always good to be on.
Many have been the distractions during this summer. The World Cup caught the attention of more Americans than usual, and then there's the ongoing worry that baseball won't finish its season. What remarkable developments in the WNBA have folks missed?
It's sort of the same as it ever was, as David Byrne once said. The L.A. Sparks and the Houston Comets are still the two best teams. The West is still the dominant conference. Really, the most surprising story has been the rise of the Washington Mystics. The Mystics, under new coach Marianne Stanley, have been revitalized. And even more impressive, they have continued their success after the injury to Shamiqua Holtzclaw, who has finally lived up to her potential and the hype as one of the best female basketball players in the world.
Have you felt any dismay or desperation on the part of the WNBA in terms of how many people are paying attention this summer?
I don't really feel that's the case. I think that the WNBA is fairly strong in every city in which it has a franchise. Outside of those areas, it might as well not exist. The league is trying to find the best mix and match of franchises and cities. And they're going to do a better job of that. They're going to make some changes. They've said, for example, there will be a franchise in the San Francisco Bay Area in 2004. A couple of teams are definitely going to move. And they're trying their best. I think overall you have to look at the WNBA as a proven concept. You can get 6,000 to 12,000 people in an arena in the summer to watch women play basketball at the highest level in the world. And three or four franchises are extremely successful and draw more than 10,000 a game.
I love the marketing ploy of having a day game every once in a while and filling the stands with day campers. I assume mostly girl day campers.
Not necessarily. Day camp people are desperate to get those kids doing anything. So you have a lot. You know, this is like a day off, but every franchise, Washington, again, was the first one to do it, and they figured, hey, what the heck, we'll just have a day game. And they got 15,000 screaming kids in there buying popcorn and Cokes and running around and driving everybody crazy. And it worked like a charm, so the league said, hey, everybody should do one, and now every team does. And it is a really good idea. It's right in their demographic. Unlike the NBA, the WNBA still is aimed at kids. It's still affordable for kids and their families. So it's a good thing. And, hey, in the summer, what else do the kids have to do?
Yeah, how many lanyards can you make?
Exactly.
The theory in the NBA is that a few stars will carry the product. If the WNBA is committed to the same marketing strategy, that would seem to put a lot of pressure on, say, Sue Bird, the extremely talented and very photogenic former UConn star now playing in Seattle. Who else feels the pressure to carry the league at this point?
The usual suspects: Lisa Leslie, Cheryl Swoops, Shamiqua Holtzclaw, Sue Bird, as you mentioned, Lauren Jackson, who was also in Seattle, who was the number one pick, who's never really quite lived up to her reputation. These kind of individual stars, really the younger stars who've come through the NCAA tournament and have had a lot of publicity. There's some people who are going to be coming out in a few years. Diana Taurasi, out of UConn, will, barring injury, will be a great player in the WNBA. A player like LaToya Thomas out of Mississippi State. These kind of individual players, especially those who can bring offense. It's very hard to score in this league. The defenses are very good. And like, in a way, sort of like soccer, the defenses are ahead of the offenses.
Clay, the WNBA, like other pro leagues, is not immune to labor disputes. The league's collective bargaining agreement expires at the end of this season. Is that a worry, or are the WNBA women happy enough to have a league that labor strife is just unlikely at this point?
Like anyone, the WNBA people, players, would like to have more money. And that's going to be a serious issue. The way the contract was structured last time, salaries were basically determined by draft position. So if you were a number one pick, you got a certain salary. Well, if a third round pick is starting, they get less money than the first round pick who's sitting on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, the players want that changed. I would assume that will happen. The players would also like free agency. That isn't going to happen. I think they realize that any kind of a work stoppage will essentially kill the league. So they'll negotiate, but I don't think we'll see anything really serious happen this fall.
As you mentioned, on the court, Los Angeles and Houston have been very successful, as usual. Washington, as you also mentioned, seems to have turned things around very dramatically. Does the second half of the season change that landscape any?
It certainly doesn't look that way. L.A. and Houston have consistently beaten the challengers in the West. Washington, you would have wondered about, but they've gone 5-2 since Shamiqua Holtzclaw went down, and she will come back, which should strengthen them. The rest of the East is just a total war. The Cleveland Rockers, for example, are in seventh place, but they're only 3.5 games out of second place.
Mm-hmm.
So anything could happen in the other 3-8 playoff spots in the East. But right now you have to say that it's Washington, L.A., and Houston battling it out, and I've got to say it's probably going to be L.A. again.
Clay Callum covers the WNBA for Full Court Press magazine. Thank you for joining us again, Clay.
Hey, always a pleasure, Bill.
When the WNBA began operations 6 years ago, the teams all played in arenas where NBA teams played. Part of the reason for the WNBA's existence was to provide summer revenues for NBA owners. But when the NBA's Charlotte Hornets left town for New Orleans at the end of the 2002 season, the WNBA Charlotte Sting remained behind. Larry Schooler of member station WFDD recently visited with the Sting to find out about life without the Hornets.
If you close your eyes and listen to the fans at the Charlotte Coliseum cheer on the Sting, you might think the game was a sellout. Think again. Paid attendance at last Saturday's game against the Cleveland Rockers was less than 5,000. That sparse turnout is nothing new in Charlotte, where the team has found itself near the league's basement in attendance. That's despite the fact that the Sting is the defending Eastern Conference champion, with players in the All-Star game each year. So why hasn't success brought fans to the stadium?
That question remains to be answered. I really have no clue.
So says Sting shooting guard Allison Feaster. But Renee Barred, the team's senior vice president for business operations, says it's important to have some historical perspective before declaring the Sting a financial bust.
Sometimes we try and hold up standards of the NBA to the WNBA, and there's just no comparison. One has been around so much longer that it's several generations older. And really, it takes a while to develop the fan base that the NBA has. And if you actually go back and look at the numbers of the first few years of the NBA's existence, we're doing similar numbers. It's just that we're impatient.
And that impatience could end up driving the Sting out of town. The WNBA says the team must increase ticket sales and corporate support if it's to remain in Charlotte. But a season ticket campaign has had limited success, and the Sting is short-staffed after losing some personnel and support when the Hornets moved away. But Renee Barred says the team may have gained more than it lost.
If over the last couple years, with all the controversy going on surrounding the Hornets, if it was a detriment or an attribute, I really can't say. However, I can say that since the relocation went through, that there's people who are willing to talk to us who have maybe not been willing to talk to us in the past because they see a definite separation of the past ownership of the team.
Besides sponsors, Hornets co-owners George Shin and Ray Woolridge also seem to alienate the fans, with everything from sexual assault lawsuits to demands for a new arena. But the Sting's all-star point guard Dawn Staley says the Hornets were still a vital piece of the Sting's marketing puzzle.
There's a fraternity, sorority type of situation here where, you know, if someone somebody like Baron Davis on the Charlotte Hornets, or David Wesley, who, you know, comes out games you know, almost on a daily basis. If they see them there, if they hear them talking about going to a Sting game, I think that helps, you know. And if you don't have that, then that's one less person in the spotlight, you know, that's not saying anything. And, you know, for us, word of mouth is basically how we get people to come in the stands.
If the Sting lost some key supporters when the Hornets moved away, they seem to have gained some important boosters. Even NBA Commissioner David Stern has supported the Sting's effort to survive in Charlotte. And the Sting has named former NBA star ML Carr as its new team president. Carr is also part of a group that is trying to bring another NBA team to Charlotte, but Carr is confident that the Sting can make it without an NBA team. Carr and the Sting are focusing their marketing efforts on families and specific niche audiences like the Girl Scouts. During Sting games, kids can choose from several activities, including face painting, balloon making, and, of course, the Papa Shot. But all the marketing and pregame fun may not do the trick, says Rick Bunnell, who has covered basketball for the Charlotte Observer since the Hornets arrived in 1988.
This is a young town, and it's a town full of people who came from other places. There are a lot of people here. You're trying to change their loyalties from places where they grew up. And in some ways, that's good because it means people are looking for something. In some ways, it's bad because it means that you don't have an automatic hook, you know, that favors you in getting things done. I think there are an awful lot of people trying to divide the sports dollar in Charlotte, and I think it's been, in some ways, it's been spread pretty thin.
Unhappily, the Sting might need the help of a higher power, as Reverend Barbara Peacock indicates in her pregame prayer. For Only a Game, I'm Larry Schuller in Charlotte.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Mike Vec has done it again. The owner of Minor League Baseball's Charleston River Dogs had previously made news with such remarkable promotional ideas as Vasectomy Night, which was canceled before it could actually occur, Tanya Harding Bat Night, and Marriage Counseling Night. On Monday evening, Vec's River Dogs staged Nobody Night. No fans were admitted to the game until after five innings had been played and the game was official, so Vec's club could claim the record for lowest attendance, zero. A killjoy at the Baseball Hall of Fame says the stunt was in vain since the official attendance figure would be based on tickets eventually sold. In baseball heaven, Mike's father, the incomparable Bill Vec, doubtless enjoyed a good laugh anyway.
And now I ain't got nobody, and nobody cares for me. I'm so standing low, and won't somebody come and take a chance with me?
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For Bill Littlefield's commentary on strike prospects for Major League Baseball, log on to our website, WBUR.org, and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Russell's Garden Center, Route 20 in Wayland, hosting a residential garden and water garden tour today from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and by Quo Vadis on Newberry Street, planning cultural tours for educated travelers. This year, discovering the culture of Transylvania. Information at 617-421-9494. Beautiful weather in the forecast for today. Mostly sunny skies this afternoon. Highs in the mid-80s. Clear skies tonight. Overnight lows in the 60s. Tomorrow and Monday, mostly sunny. Highs in the upper 80s to near 90. 66 degrees in Boston at 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, six-man football goes international. But first, Tuesday night's All-Star game ended in a tie, a result that had fans howling for Commissioner Bud Selig's resignation, if not his head. On Thursday, the season began again, but nobody seems to know whether the entire schedule will be played. Joining me now by phone to address those concerns and talk about some actual baseball, as well as ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
My pleasure, Bill. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much.
On Wednesday, a day after the All-Star game, Commissioner Selig maintained that a mystery team might not be able to make the payroll next week and that a second mystery team might not make it through the season. The mystery team number one has since somehow found the money to make the payroll, but what possible purpose can this sort of chatter serve?
Well, that's a good question, Bill. In fact, I talked to Commissioner Selig about this, and I asked him who the mystery team was, and he says, I'm not telling you, and I will never tell you because that would cause too much embarrassment for the team. I don't know why he brought that out the time that he did. Everybody knows there are severe financial problems in baseball. It seems like a PR move. It seems like a grandstanding move by Bud Selig, so everyone will know what we already know, that there are big problems out there. I don't think he needed to come out and say that the day after the All-Star game, but maybe he needed a little sympathy for himself and for the game, given how badly things are going right now.
Tim, officially the players' union and management are trying to negotiate a new basic agreement. The players' position seems to me to be that any restriction on free agent signings, whether via a salary cap or a tax on clubs with exceptionally high payrolls, is simply unacceptable. The owners' position seems to be that without some adjustment of that sort, the business can't continue. Where is the room for compromise?
Well, I don't see the room for compromise now. And, Bill, believe me, I'm the most optimistic guy in the world, and nobody loves baseball more than me. But I just don't see this getting together in time before there is a work stoppage. I think they are so far away from a compromise, meaning the union refuses to budge on the luxury tax issue, and ownership refuses to budge on several other issues that I just don't see how they're going to get it together in time to stop the players from walking out, which I am absolutely convinced they will do if nothing changes in the equation in the next month.
Tim, each time a season is interrupted, the prophets of doom say that fans will never return to baseball. They'll be so disappointed. I know those prophets will always be wrong as regards you, but what do you think about all the other fans?
I think a lot of fans, frankly, haven't come back from the 1994 strike. I think that's one reason why attendance is down slightly this year. But if they walk this time and we lose another World Series and any of this slips into next season and we lose part of another season and all of this is possible, I really think that a lot more fans will never come back. I mean, we're in a different era today, Bill, after September 11th and all sorts of other things that have happened since the last strike, including football becoming king in this country and baseball, and I hate to say this, is no longer America's pastime. This is a really dangerous area they're in, and I've talked to players and ownership alike saying, you understand where we are? And they said, yes, we do, but we need to get this fixed, and we need to get it fixed now. If it means sitting out for a year and a half, that's what we need to do. But I'm saying you sit out for a year and a half, so many people will never come back, and I hope baseball understands that.
Given that the players and the owners are smart enough to understand the risks of another work stoppage, why can't they find some way to approach and solve this problem rather than a work stoppage, which is what it always seems to come down to in baseball?
Well, it's such an easy question, Bill, and they just refuse to answer it. And part of the problem is that the personalities are involved here. Bud Selig and Don Fehr do not like each other, and I don't think they trust each other, and I'm not even sure they respect each other. And those are the two guys who are making this deal. So to me, we need two different negotiators, but we're not going to get two different negotiators. And I really wonder if these are the men who are going to be able, who are capable of getting this deal done.
All right, I want to make a leap of faith now. Let's assume that the season does somehow continue to completion. The Yankees and Mariners would seem to be the favorites to keep going strong in the American League, or am I cutting out too many teams by saying that?
No, I think you're absolutely right, but I really think you have to include the Red Sox as a playoff team, as a wild card team, because I think the way they've played, they have a chance. And if they make it to the playoffs, they're a dangerous team with Derek Lowe and Pedro Martinez in their rotation the way they're throwing the ball lately. Oakland on the outside is another team that has a chance to make the playoffs, and if it does, with its starting pitching, they are a very dangerous team.
Elsewhere in the National League, the Dodgers have the second-best record. Arizona's right behind L.A., looks to be in fine shape. It could hardly be otherwise as long as Curt Schilling and Randy Johnson are still Diamondbacks, I guess. Meanwhile, the Braves have reassumed their customary position as division leaders, and Atlanta had the best record in baseball at the break. Do any of these teams slip in the second half?
You know, the Braves are not going to slip. They are the team that I picked to go to the World Series. So for once, I might even be right. But the Dodgers are the surprise team in the West, certainly for me. And I don't see them slipping because their starting pitching is so much better than anybody thought it would be. And therefore, that puts them right there with the Diamondbacks and the Giants in that division. So the two best divisions are the West, the AL and the NL West. And I don't see slippage from the Dodgers or anyone else in either of the West. And I think we're going to have two great races out there.
Tim, here's where I say I hope we get to see those two great races and not end up staring at article after article about who ought to compromise and who's being too stubborn.
Well, I'm with you on this, Bill, because I dread more than anything sitting around in a hotel lobby chasing down millionaire owners and chasing down millionaire players. And they're fighting over even more money. And if they can't understand that and they can't see the damage this is going to do, then I have no sympathy for them. But I have great sympathy for the game and the fans. And if they don't get to see an end to this season, that will be a travesty of the highest order.
ESPN's Tim Kirkjian analyzes baseball on Only a Game from time to time. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
If you have not thought seriously about football since the Super Bowl and do not intend to do so again, at least until NFL training camps open in a few weeks, you missed last week's Can-Am Bowl. For football players in lots of small towns from New Mexico to Canada, that would be unthinkable. From the site of the event, Amy Jo Eamon has this report.
The U.S. is in white, Canada in red. The bleachers are almost full. It's not too hot, not too windy. Perfect football weather in Central Butte, Saskatchewan. Central Butte, population 440, is in the heart of the Canadian prairie. Green fields, gently rolling hills, and big open skies, 2 hours north of Montana. It's this year's host of the Can-Am Bowl. Your usual football game. It's six-man football. Six-man is the football of small towns, football of the pickup game in the park. Fast and furious, hard-hitting, and not played in very many high schools at all.
That linebacker from the Bridger Bats in Montana, number 33, Chris Ewing.
The American team has some of the best players and coaches from Colorado, New Mexico, Montana, and Nebraska. The Canadians come from, well, just from Saskatchewan, the only province in Canada that plays six-man high school football. All the players come from communities that have one thing in common. They're small. Scott Turnbull coaches at Arthur County High School in Nebraska.
We're the smallest high school in Nebraska right now. We had 27 boys and girls, grades 9 through 12, this last year. And so I only had 11 on my football team, which was a little tight. But my assistant and I, we take turns playing quarterback and, you know, against our number one defense. And then we play some defensive back against our guys so that they can try and get a look at a full offense and defense.
Six-man football was invented in Nebraska during the Dirty 30s, when hard times took a toll on small towns and people moved away. Well, it's hard times again. Small towns are shrinking and six-man football is growing. Phil Giebert coaches at the Lutheran Collegiate Bible Institute in Outlook, Saskatchewan.
It gives a chance for the small towns to actually have a chance to play. Otherwise, they just couldn't play because there wouldn't be enough guys. But six-man is a very wide-open game, and guys are used to going to the park to play. This is kind of like going to the park to play, but you got equipment, and you still hit hard.
Come on, guys. Stop where he's at. Get up, grab him!
Yvonne Stone is watching her son Michael play for the Canadians. They come from Loreburn, population 140, where six-man football is the biggest game in town.
As soon as the kids get in grade 9 and they know that some of the grade 12s are trying out for this team, they all say, oh, I can't wait till I'm in grade 12 so I can try out. Oh, I want to make sure and be on that team. I want to hit some Americans.
Run up, run up!
By the end of the first quarter, the game is tied at 8. In six Can-Am Bowls, Canada has beaten the Americans only once, even though they play by Canadian rules. For example, there are 3 downs, not 4, and the quarterback can run with the ball, unlike the American game. The Canadian rules are a bit confusing for American parents like Barry Troyer from Rappelje, Montana, population 68.
I think they should have got a sheet to us to hand out a little bit so we could understand some of the new ones, but it's a lot of fun just trying to figure it out, and both teams are playing well, so good game.
The Can-Am Bowl is always played in a small Saskatchewan town, and since everyone comes from a small town, they don't miss all the amenities of a big-town stadium. The turf is hard and yellow in a few places. A couple of girls from the local dance club are selling pop from a squeaky wagon. The PA system is so loud, the sound is distorted, but there is a sky cam. That's the guy with the camera high up in the bucket of a utility truck. Game videos are available for $20. It turns out to be a game the Canadians might not want to watch again soon. They take a beating from the American team in the second half.
8 seconds remaining here. Score 67-30 in favor of Team USA and the American boys. Can we put the exchange rate on that? What's it making about?
The Americans win 67-30. Thanks in part to Brooks Bland from Tatum, New Mexico, who sets a record for interceptions.
Yes, ma'am, 6 to be exact. After the first 2, I thought they'd quit throwing, but they kept throwing them, so I did my job, tried to pick them off.
Claire Lefebvre from Carrot River is the Canadian MVP. It's not the loss he'll remember most, but the friendships made. Both teams arrived early in Central Butte, where they ate, slept, and played together for 3 days before the big game.
It was great to meet everybody and meet everybody they played against. Instead of hating them, you get to get buddies with them and meet them, and it's a pretty good experience. You never like your opponents. You just go and try and hit them and whatever, but they're all good guys now that I know them.
Later this month, Texas hosts the All-Americas Bowl, in which the best six-man players from Texas take on everyone else. Texas is a six-man powerhouse. To try to beat the Texans, the other American and Canadian players will team up against them. One of the spectators at the Can-Am Bowl is six-man fanatic Tommy Wells of Texas. He helps start these cross-border showdowns. He says six-man players are finally getting the attention they deserve at big games like the All-Americas Bowl.
Last year down at our game, we had 3 guys sign college scholarships right there after the game. So it's really more and more college coaches are paying attention because these kids are overall the top athletes. There is no 320-pound fat guys running around playing line. So you got to do it all.
After the game, everyone stays on the field for a group photo and goodbyes between new friends. Players like Canadian Hans Johansson say there's no room for hard feelings.
Because we're all from small towns and we all get along just great, and it was just a blast. Yeah. Oh, it was a fun.
For Only a Game, I'm Amy Jo Eamon in Central Butte, Canada.
You're listening to Only a Game. There is one significant difference between Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig and the various other heads and former heads of major corporations under fire and indictment these days. While the scoundrels running Enron, WorldCom, Merck, and the rest have criminally exaggerated their earnings and their worth, Commissioner Bud has been loudly maintaining that nobody but a fool or a masochist would invest in the business he represents, a doomed collection of rickety organizations presided over by egotists too pig-headed to recognize their competitors are also their partners and employing a narcissistic collection of spoiled, albeit united, punks. Baseball isn't in as much trouble as Mr. Selig says it's in. Nothing could be. As long as the owners can cash out with a profit, how much some of them allegedly lose in a particular season or even a particular decade doesn't mean much. Nor should we worry at predictions that the customer's patience is finite. Interruptions of seasons past and the loss of the 1994 World Series have suggested that no outrage is too great for baseball fans to bear. Give them a pennant race or a home run contest between two guys willing to smile for the cameras, and their iron resolve to boycott the games will melt like a lover's resentment when the phone finally rings. Baseball has a safety net Commissioner Bud's colleagues in the business world can only envy. People love the product. No act or pronouncement is sufficiently self-serving or dishonest to drive them away for long. That's another distinction between the grand old game and the corporations currently stomping on Wall Street with both boots, and it suggests something about how we might react to all the doom and gloom coming from the commissioner's office. As the rhetoric boils over and the owners' cries of imminent disaster crash up against the players' case for the status quo only more, we ought to try to understand the circus for the entertainment that it is and will be. Unlike the self-serving lies, manipulations, and cash grabs of Mr. Selig's counterparts in the boardrooms of the publicly traded companies, the commissioner's bombast and bumbling haven't cost us a thing. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter McLennan and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service, whose 100 employees in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick appreciate the support of WBUR listeners. They'll fix it so it breaks. Online at directtire.com. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Boston Red Sox lost to the Toronto Blue Jays for the first time since the season opener this year. Toronto shut out Boston 5-0 last night. The two teams play again this afternoon in Toronto. The Red Sox say tickets will go on sale by telephone only at 10 o'clock this morning for a Fenway Park tribute to the late Ted Williams. The event is scheduled for the evening of July 22nd and will feature highlights of Williams' career and appearances by many who played with or knew the Hall of Famer. Proceeds from the event will benefit the Jimmy Fund. In addition to the ticketed event, the Red Sox plan to open Fenway Park free of charge from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on July 22nd for fans who want to pay their respects individually. In Major League Soccer, the New England Revolution hosts Kansas City this afternoon at CMGI Field in Foxborough. The Boston Breakers are on the road against Carolina tonight. Find out what's coming up on your favorite WBUR programs with personal updates sent directly to your desktop. To sign up, go to WBUR.org and click on Newsletter. In the forecast, sunny skies today, highs in the 80s, tonight's lows in the 60s.
I'm Jose Maso, host of WBUR's Con Salsa. Cuba and the United States. Both countries share a love of baseball, a good cigar, and great jazz. Find out what else we have in common when you join Sylvia Pajoli and me on the next Citizens of the World Tour to Cuba this fall. Learn more about the trip and sample the cuisine of Cuba at a reception this Monday, July 15th. Reserve your space by calling 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with the author of a new book celebrating the myriad passions of the racing life. But first, here to discuss the week's sports news is our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Let's get the most grotesque story out of the way right away, Charlie. I'm sure you'll agree that Ted Williams deserved better than the sideshow presently in production regarding the disposition of his remains.
Charles Dickens rewritten to Ray Bradbury. What can I tell you about it?
It only gets worse. The
interesting story, besides the somewhat more erudite debate as to whether they freeze all of Ted Williams or simply his head for these purposes, is the fact that basically this is a fairly run-of-the-mill dispute. If one side wanted to cremate Ted Williams and one side wanted to bury him, it wouldn't look and it wouldn't have had the kind of legs this story has because of this sort of science fiction element of the cryonics thing, plus the incredible chutzpah of his son, John Henry Williams, who apparently was planning to send out the DNA at cost.
It's worse and worse.
Although given John Henry's performance in the rookie league, there might not be a lot to this DNA thing in the first place.
This week, baseball commissioner Bud Selig posed a riddle to sports writers and fans. Charlie, guess which team might be out of money by Monday and which one probably won't make it to the end of the season. Good pre-negotiation strategy there?
There is absolutely no excuse for the public career of Bud Selig anymore. Six teams are going to go out of business. Which ones, Bud? Humana, 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 competitive imbalance, humana, humana. A team is going to go broke by Monday. Humana, 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 competitive imbalance, humana, humana. You know what? That team, whichever team it was, looked under the cushions of the sofa and found the payroll there. It's like Uncle Billy in It's a Wonderful Life. They, you know, some team owner looked at the string on his fingers. Pay the players. I remember now.
Speaking of baseball, who would have guessed that the 2002 World Cup would have had such a profound influence on the grand old game, an all-star game that ends in a tie? Were you outraged?
No, because I was long in bed by the time this cataclysmic decision was made. If baseball had any imagination, well, if baseball had any imagination, it wouldn't have Bud Selig for its commissioner. But if baseball had any imagination, you know, bring somebody in out of the stands to serve up a 50-mile-an-hour fastball that Barry Bonds can hit 10 miles and end the game.
Absolutely, it's over. Charlie, since last we spoke, the Williams sisters, Serena and Venus, have established that they are perhaps even further ahead of their opposition than Tiger Woods is ahead of his. Do we worry now that the only player who can give Williams a game is Williams?
Well, no. See, I'm not worried about that. On the men's side, you've got incredible parity among a bunch of guys that most people wouldn't recognize if they walked naked down Fifth Avenue at high noon. I think you've got what is a real problem on the men's side and a problem on the women's side, which is pretty much people trying to find a way to have a problem with this.
One person not cheering the success of women's tennis is Australia's chief drug tester. John Mendoza said this week that performance-enhancing drugs are widely used in tennis, especially on the women's side, where players need to be, his words now, abnormal in body physique to reach number one. I hate to sound cynical here, but is this why Jennifer Capriati and Venus Williams have publicly opposed out-of-competition drug testing?
I have no idea, but opposing out-of-competition drug testing, which is a long-held position of my own, and as you can tell, I am not abnormal in body physique in any ways, at least any way ever enhanced by medicines. No, you know what? Tough. If John Mendoza has a problem with big, strong women, then John Mendoza needs help.
Like all sports, pro basketball likes to nudge its way into the news during its offseason, hence the production the NBA annually makes of its draft. But the coverage basketball got this week, it could do without. What do you make of Allen Iverson's most recent late-night adventure?
Well, these cases completely depend upon what your local authorities are willing to do with them. Now, Lynn Abraham, the district attorney in Philadelphia, has a reputation of something of a showboat. You've got 14 counts lined up here, including four felonies against Allen Iverson. I think probably what changes the matter in this case is the gun.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked before about how athletes are rather heavily armed these days. Guns are handy. Guns are part of the culture. If you listen to the National Rifle Association, that's exactly how it should be. But I think that Allen Iverson has chosen the wrong venue to do something like this, because you do have a prosecutor who likes to see herself on television, and this is a big fish. So what might have been an ordinary or somewhat more than ordinary domestic disturbance can get blown up into something quite serious.
What do you think the likelihood is that Allen Iverson actually ends up in jail?
I think better than 50-50. I don't see the Philadelphia District Attorney letting this one go.
Commander Lennox Lewis has said that he may very well fight Mike Tyson again as long as somebody can come up with $30 million. Otherwise, he'll retire.
What are the odds that somebody comes up with that $30 million by the end of next week? I would almost guarantee that you will see a rematch. Because I'll tell you what, I'm beginning to believe that Mike Tyson has realized that his last career is as a public expiation for society's sins. Mm. I believe he's got some sort of weird bent to punish himself by getting the everlasting aspirations beaten out of him in public. And I think this is the latest manifestation of how nutty he is. And I think Lennox Lewis would be glad to oblige him about 12 times.
Especially for $30
million. If the price is right, exactly.
Finally, Charlie, you may want to send out a plea for mercy to the New York department store Bergdorf Goodman. One of their employees, a Miss Christy Lee Wilcox, was arrested for running onto the field at Yankee Stadium and giving Derek Jeter her phone number. Ms. Wilcox is concerned. She's worried she may be fired as a result.
Well, I certainly hope she isn't, and I certainly hope Derek gives her a call and sends her an autograph. I would point out that the woman was shoeless when she ran on the field. This was considered of some import in the event. And having spent a week in South Carolina, not far, I might add, from the ancestral and late-in-life home of shoeless Joe Jackson, I can appreciate the shoeless, dateless woman running on the field.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe magazine as well as for Esquire magazine, and he's a regular here at Only a Game. And the only phone numbers he has are the ones that he's looked up himself. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
In the introduction to her book about her relationship to horse racing and the track, Nan Mooney writes, "Racing's not about what you expect. It's about letting go of expectations, taking a gamble. How else could you possibly fall in love?" That's fair warning that My Racing Heart, subtitled The Passionate World of Thoroughbreds and the Track, aims to finish several lengths ahead of most books set in a sport, at least in terms of its ambition. Nan Mooney joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Good to be here.
Your grandmother introduced you to horse racing by inviting you to watch the Kentucky Derby with her on TV, and she apparently saw in racing a way to teach you a great deal about racing and lots of other things as well.
She really did. She was quite an unconventional woman and a real adventurer. Spent time as a fur trapper, taking pack trips into the glaciers in Alaska. And she grew up basically at the turn of the century. She was born in 1889. So she was always looking for ways to exercise that unconventional bone. And the racetrack had really given that to her. And I think she felt it was really important that I have something that could give that to me, because I was from the beginning sort of a rebellious child as well, and I think she it was important to her that I find somewhere to channel that kind of energy. And so she chose a racetrack as a place that could teach me a lot about the both the pluses and minuses of life and how people and horses and societies and everything operate.
In a chapter entitled Leaps of Faith, you describe a race limited to 7 colts and 1 filly, none of whom have raced before. And the guy in front of you in the betting line shrugs after making a series of complicated bets, and he says, "God only knows," which I gather is a fair part of the charm of the whole game.
Oh, absolutely. Those are my favorite races, where those horses, they start out and they really don't, you know, they've practiced and they've done test runs and things, but they really don't know what's happening. And they're all young and gangly, and they get in the starting gate and it opens and they're off. And in that sort of less than 2 minutes that they're taking, they're usually short races for the two-year-old, maybe 5 or 6 furlongs, they start to become racehorses. They find their feet and they figure out what they're doing. And, you know, they're not quite there yet. They veer all over the track and they experiment some, but it's exciting to see. And you really have no idea which ones are going to take to it right away and which ones are going to be totally lost.
At one point in My Racing Heart, you introduce your reader to Cleavy, who's a groom thoroughly dedicated to the horses in his charge. And you say of him, "Those horses have a way of filling you. Anything else becomes just pocket change." But you did not fall into the daily work of the track yourself. Why was that?
I didn't. I think in a way I was almost spoiled growing up as nothing more than a fan. I always got to have the racetrack on my terms, and I could move through. I could spend time in the mornings watching the horses work out. I could be there in the afternoons. I could bet or not bet. I could be there every day for weeks, and then I could disappear for months. And it could feed my passion exactly how I wanted it to. And I think I wanted to keep it that way.
It's interesting because you worry at one point when you realize you're not going to be connected to the track except as a fan. You're worried that you've let your grandmother down. You almost don't want to tell her that.
Absolutely. Growing up, I was always sure that I would do something involved with the track. I wanted to be a jockey for a long time, or until it became apparent I was going to turn out to be 5'11", which doesn't really work in that profession.
No.
I just assumed that Maymay, my grandmother, was grooming me for some sort of job at the racetrack. It had never occurred to me till I went to her that she had never had any sort of job at the racetrack, that she was just a fan. And so, of course, when I went to her and said, well, I don't think I want to do anything at the racetrack. I think I just want it to be my sport that I love. And she said, well, of course. What else would it be?
She knew all along.
Wise woman, yes.
You come to especially admire several people connected to the track. One is the magnificently successful former jockey, Angel Cordero, who, besides winning a great deal, was also accused of fixing races. Was the possible dark side part of the attraction here?
Oh, without question. I mean, I think anything that's at all interesting has an underbelly to it, and the racetrack is no exception. People take huge risks there, and they're not always wise ones, but I think that that's the way you should live your life, and that's part of the excitement. You really don't know what's happening, and fortunes can turn on a dime, and it's just a lot of guesswork and possibility, and that's the charm of the track.
Inevitably, the matter of betting on the horses does enter this chronicle of the track and your relationship to it. You write about a gambler named Albert who, and I'm quoting again, was so immersed in playing the horses that it dyed his skin and slopped into his eyeballs, affecting the very way he thought and moved. Albert really taught you, after a fairly long association, that you couldn't relate to the track as he did.
He did. Albert actually taught me a lot about the racetrack. I mean, he spent his lifetime. He had charts and index cards and books on animal psychology, and he knew everything about every trainer and every horse who's, you know, what their grandmother had done. And he knew everything. There was no time in his life for anything else. And again, I realized that the gambling doesn't pull me that way. I need the whole picture. I'm just as drawn by the horses and the personalities. And yeah, I bet. But to do that to the exclusion of everything else, that was not my relationship to the racetrack. That was his.
Albert and others acknowledged, though, that you had a sense. The horses kind of spoke to you. The winner in particular would sometimes almost wink at you before a race.
Yeah, emphasis on the sometimes. But again, I think that's something my grandmother taught me to be able to pick up. I think the horses send signals when you go and look at them before the races. They send signals whether they're ready to run or not. And, you know, you're looking for ears that are perked up and sort of a little sidestepping trot and just the horses that look full of themselves and have a lot of energy. And occasionally you see it and it's just obvious. A horse is glowing in the paddock and you got to bet on those horses, and they do win.
Thoroughbred horses are fragile animals, and in one of the most powerful passages in the book, you write about the consequence of that fact. Could you read from the second paragraph on page 179, Nan?
Sure. It was a sprint race, just 5 furlongs. My filly broke at the front of the pack and stayed there, gliding along like a gift and leaving all the other horses strung out behind. Then, as she swung around the turn and came to the head of the lane, something happened. Something too tiny to spot, one heel clipping another, a glitch in the track, or maybe nothing at all. And she dropped to her knees right there in the middle of the home stretch. Somehow all the other horses kept going, parting like water around a rock. My filly froze on her twin kneecaps, as if in prayer, as if she knew what would happen when she tried to stand again and was putting it off as long as possible. Finally, she rose on 3 strong, steady legs. She tried a step on the fourth and rocked back in surprise. The hoof wouldn't meet the ground. Instead, it dangled from her shin with the skin and flesh broken away, and the end of a bone jutting out snapped clean in half. Since I couldn't bear to keep looking at her, I turned toward the people around me. They were all doing the same, swiveling their necks, shaking their heads, imprinting something they wished they could erase. I glanced back toward the track. The filly took a stumbling step or two, as if expecting her other leg to reappear. Then she stopped moving entirely. She didn't look panicked, only bewildered, and maybe a little bit betrayed. "She's a goner," mumbled an old man next to me. Then he made the sign of a cross, and though I hadn't been inside a church since sixth grade, I crossed myself too.
Following that description, you write, "Staying with the racetrack means slipping away from black and white and residing in various shades of gray. It isn't about the nature of the track, it's about the nature of love." That's only two-thirds of the way through the book. I wonder a little how you found that there was anything more left to write.
Well, my relationship, as that says, my relationship with the track is very complex. And honestly, that horses break down is not something I've come to a happy peace with. I don't have the feeling that, oh, well, that happens and you move on. It's incredibly upsetting every time you see it. But the things that draw me are still there and they haven't changed. And I suppose you just find a way to live with it. The horses love to run. The people do everything they can to make sure the horses don't break down. And for me, that's enough to keep going.
Nan Mooney, who writes for The Blood Horse, the journal of record for thoroughbred horse racing, is the author of My Racing Heart, published by HarperCollins. Nan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much, Bill. This was great.
Say a prayer for the cowgirl. Her horse ran away. She'll walk till she finds him, her darling, her stray. But the river's in flood and the roads are awash, and the bridges break up in the panic of loss.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, read a review of My Racing Heart, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word this week, Nan Mooney shows herself to be a real radio professional.
You want me to just play with these buttons and see what happens? That sounds dangerous.
Don't worry, Nan. I don't know what those buttons do either. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. Don't push the button yet, Tad. I'll see you next week.
And she leans on his neck and whispers low, "Whither thou goest, I will go." And they turn as one, and they head for the plain. No need for the whip, oh, no need for the rein. Now the clasp of this union, who fastens it tight? Who snaps it asunder the very next night? Some say it's him, some say it's her, some say love's like smoke beyond all repair.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WBUR.
Radio.
This is WBUR.